Thank you very much, Martin, and it was really a pleasure to listen to this talk, and we will have a chance to ask questions, but now I would pass the word to Trevor to come with the sequel to this story, and then we will get back to...
I'll do my best. I have a rather daunting task of discussing 1980s music in Czechoslovakia, which, as you see, is a scene that is filled with like many layers, many scenes, many groups, different external and internal forces, and begs different questions, certainly, than really the music of the 60s and 70s in Czechoslovakia. In order to engage with 1980s in Czechoslovakia, I'll use one band in particular tonight called Divuk as an entry point into the particularities and also the continuity with the non-official, semi-official musicine that happened in the 1970s, which Dr. Makovec just spoke about. Mainly, we can accomplish this by looking at kind of a three-tiered, interrelated contributors of gender, genre, and generation, of which the band Divuk straddles. Additionally, this band drew on a variety of musical streams from the 1970s, which I'll briefly discuss. And hopefully, through this analysis, we can better understand, mechanisms between... Yes?
Sure.
Okay, sorry. So basically, through this analysis, hopefully...
Oh, that's another option. Just we are afraid that then he will switch off the music and then it will be...
I'll stand, it's no problem. So hopefully we can better understand the mechanisms between social life and music in Czechoslovakia during this time, and also hopefully we can, I'll give you some kind of mental map of these different bands and scenes during this time. So today I'll put these bands in an international context as well as see production of the external and internal forces involved in the creation of subculture. Additionally, I'd like to talk a little bit with some of the theoretical discussion on the role of music in social life that can give us some tools for talking about subculture and counterculture. But first, I'll just begin by a brief look at some of the music in the 1970s to identify these different forms of musicing, which, you know, talk to these structures of alternity or alternativeness that were created, and then look at these bands in the 80s. So very quickly, if we look at some of the different musical streams happening in Czechoslovakia in the 1970s, of course, again, I should say, and these are not really such clear and cut differences between these groups. There were sometimes, of course, musicians going back and forth between these and playing, but we can identify about four different streams. Firstly, we have the underground, as Dr. Makovec was speaking about. We have these non-official band musicians that existed in this rather closed community of private performances. And of course, PPU or Plastic People Universe and DG307 were kind of the main influences, the main sound of these groups of the underground community. Another kind of musical stream that was happening this time was this association called Shafran, which basically was established in 1972, which incorporated a lot of these kind of 60s hippies protest singers from their plan in Charles Bridge in 68. And basically in 1972, they formed this association called Shafran. And then they were, I guess, kind of straddling this official, non-official line, kind of a semi-official. They were able to release albums. For example, one famous musician from Shafran, Jaroslav Hutka, he did an album of like Moravian folk songs, and he was able to release it, but not with his name on it. So they were kind of in between some of these official and non-official lines. The music of Shafran was basically acoustic guitar, singer-songwriters, having maybe a little more political undertones lyrically than those of the underground, and maybe drawn into the socio-political situation a little bit more than the underground. Thirdly, we have the alternative section. To describe these guys, basically, you could say they are, if they could have played officially without compromising their music or their art, they would have. Unfortunately, all musicians were subject to requalification exams after 68 or after 1970 in Czechoslovakia. So these musicians then, when they were not allowed to play, they kind of formed this alternative music, which they kind of, this is the main impulse to what happened to the jazz rock movement that happened, well, all across many countries in Eastern Europe, but in Czechoslovakia, the jazz rock was led by this alternative section. And jazz rock is basically what it sounds like, elements of rock and roll, of rhythms, tonalities, also used with elements of jazz, such as improvising, more saxophones and trumpets, things like this. However, the jazz rock did not use any lyrics, so it was kind of a strategy for them to manipulate more bureaucratic structures of state control. If they did not have lyrics, then they could not be censored because they're lyrics. So they're able to kind of use this as a way to play in the 70s and also into the 80s. This fourth stream, we have the Janus section. The Janus section was an official organization established in 1971, which they did have quite a lot of contact with people in the non-official structures, non-official social life during this time. Amongst many activities, Janus section would publish a bulletin. They also would have hold jam sessions. Most importantly, they put on concerts and festivals, the largest one called Proud Jazz Days. And then from this, you have like people from the alternative section playing at these festivals called Proud Jazz Days. So you have a wider audience hearing this kind of music than perhaps these close concerts of the underground. So basically, for these four streams, then we can say what was kind of established structures of alternity or structures of alternativeness. And basically, we can say this is ways of feeling, being, thinking, and knowing that comprise and constitute non-official social life. So we can kind of see how these patterns were being established in the 1970s. And of course, music became a significant factor as the trajectory of this structure of alternity into the 80s. And these trajectories are very much emotional structures containing orientations to symbols, which produce varying systems of collective representations, depending on both performers and the audience. These systems of collective representations can include musical performing practice, how these were developed and produced, musical cultural materials, audience predilections, habits of music reception, ideas and values, but what constituted true music. So these all contribute to this emergence of social structures of the underground, alternative, non-commercial, non-official rock in the 70s. So already we can see this happening throughout the 70s, and by the late 70s, early 80s, we have, a socio-musical script already in place for these musicians in the 80s, which they can interpret and manipulate how they want to. And basically, my point is that the 80s just not come out from, the musicians in the 80s did not come from anywhere. They had very much these structures in place. Talking about this idea of music affording emotional structures, music can also afford trajectories of identity that provide continuity from past experiences to present situations, and that can form future situations. Very simply, I think we all experience this. We listen to music that we listened to 10 years ago, and we think about who we were, what our identity was, how we felt at that time. And we listen to it nowadays, and we think, okay, I was like that, but also that's still part of me, or that's not a part of me, and it forms us nowadays, and then we listen to that 10 years from now. We still have this kind of continuity of identity through this listening. From this point, we can begin to understand how structures of alternative and alternative identities were created and built in the 60s and 70s. How people articulated certain forms of social life at this time to music such as Zappa, Captain Beefheart, Velvet Underground, even King Crimson. And so how this trajectory carried the structure of alternative and also resonated with musicians in the 80s. Again, this music does not predetermine action, does not predetermine a resonance, but it does allow users and listeners cultural material to make connections to and also to manipulate as a resource. And this continuity between bands in the 70s into the 80s, of course, can best be felt by this legacy of the Plastic Evil universe. In the early 80s, there were many bands also trying to copy the style that we're listening to from Dr. Malkovich, which is not such an easy style to copy. Of course, Mela Flossa, a bass player, very talented musician, and he had a very strong way of playing the bass. But still, people were trying to replicate this. So we had people taking PPU's musical material, their style, the sonorities, the instrumentation, these heavy bass riffs, violins, saxophones, vocal stylings of the non-singer, the non-virtuoso, even using Plastic Evil's complete lack of syncopation in their music. So we have bands starting to use some of this music from the 70s, so they're starting to use musical structures as well. And if you can look at this, you can kind of conceptualize these musical structures as what Bob Witkin calls holding forms. So it's quote-unquote, holding forms are a set of motifs that proceed and serve as a reference point for lines of feeling, lines of conduct over time. Holding forms thus provide a touchstone to which actors may return to as they engage in collective expressive activity. They are templates with which agency takes shape and to which actors may refer and renew themselves as types of emotional agents. So I think it's very, very important to understand these musical structures were also carrying on into the 80s. But there's narrative structures. And this we can kind of make conceptualized better by looking at Victor Turner, what he calls action paradigms, which are very congruent to holding forms. But action paradigms are basically cultural materials such as narratives and imagery that may be used in ways to plot courses of action. And going back to Ivan Martinioros, which Dr. Malkovich spoke about, in 1974, he wrote his kind of manifesto of the underground called Report on the Third Czech Musical Revival. And this is basically describing bands like Plastic People Universe and DG307 and the values in the community around these people. So as a third musical revival, certainly there's more. And then from Eurus's interpretation, first musical revival happened 19th century around Smetana and Dvorak. Second musical revival happened in the 60s when big beat and rock and roll kind of started to penetrate into Czechoslovakia, well, all over the world. Third Czech revival was the underground musicians. So from this idea, this narrative of these revivals, we can suggest that this new wave of music that happened in the 80s as the fourth revival. So with these narrative of revivals in place, these musical structures in place, these structures of alternative in place, the 80s generation did not just ride in on this fashion of new wave that happened across the world, but they actually had kind of a solid map from where they could orientate themselves to and plot courses of action. So briefly, so looking at the new wave, of course, we must understand this new wave, of course, was very much an international phenomenon that happened in the mid to late 70s and 80s. Here we can see like this charge was led by bands such as The Residents, Patti Smith, Devo, Joy Division, Talking Heads, Clash, Annie Lennox, Laurie Anderson. So we have a huge plethora of bands. Of course, even here we see different styles and different types of music all coming in. So the new wave brought in indeed a new wave of everything. It was of new styles, new ways of performing, very, very diverse. And similarly, the same happened in many other countries. Right? In Czechoslovakia, there's similarly a same explosion of groups and styles that were incredibly diverse. But given the time, I want to just speak about really one band, as I mentioned before, the band Dibuk. What's interesting with Dibuk, you can really see, of course, this was an all-women group, which is interesting for this time. Basically, it started in 1979, two women getting together out of the gymnasium, playing together, playing acoustic guitars, joined by two of their friends later, began what they were called Plin and changed to Dibuk in 1984. And again, this is kind of contrasting to some of what Dr. Makovets was speaking about. So these women were very accomplished instrumentalists. They're educated at university, not really from a working class background as some of the musicians in the underground were. So you have already this kind of difference happening here. When Dibuk started playing, they were not really taken so seriously at different festivals. Many people just thought they were, organized by some manager to go on the stage and just kind of some kind of laugh or something like this. But of course, they had to then gain this respect through their music over really quite a long time. Of course, it's not being taken seriously precisely because they're women. Kind of points to how musical actors attach connotations to the things that then they can orientate to the social circumstances on the basis of these perceived meanings. But the members of Dibuk were then able to re-signify to a certain degree perceived meanings of what it meant to be a musician in Czechoslovakia at this time, what it meant to be a rocker or a person in a new wave. Most importantly, that female instrumentalists do exist. And furthermore, this also reinforced certain perceived meanings that the new wave was a new wave and women did not need to be relegated to the role, the token role of only a singer. If we look back in the 60s and 70s in Czechoslovakia, we can see that this is where women are really only seen. I'm speaking only about performing, only about music, but only as a singer, if they're present at all. And certainly within a counterculture such as the underground, you kind of conceptualize it as the ecology, the arts, and there were musicians, writers, poets, visual artists, intellectuals, all mutually affecting artistic and social life. And certainly there were women present in this as well, as Dr. Makovets spoke about. But if I'm talking about only performing, then Duke is definitely, there's not much to go on for Duke. There's not many cultural resources for Duke to build on. However, there were some artists, I believe I mentioned Shafran, these Association of Acoustic Guitarists. There was one woman, Dagmar Vonkova, who played very, very aggressively, two or three strings, and when really singing very, quite aggressively as well. So this was maybe one impulse of really a woman instrumentalist happening in Czechoslovakia and from the 60s, 70s, and 80s. So Dibuk is again a very interesting kind of symbol of this new wave. Again, if we speak more generally about music, in any musical canon, we have musical myths, we could say, which are often become a symbolic structure informing performance. These are ideas of like the diva, the child prodigy, the misunderstood genius. These all kind of stock characters, which are myths of music. So Dibuk was kind of essential in breaking this myth that we found in Czechoslovak music, that It's not only a woman as a singer, but also women as instrumentalists. So they're able to kind of establish this new form of collective representation. Very quickly, we'll take a look at the book and listen. Okay. And again, you can probably also see there's some great shots of the audience as well. You can see how they were performing as well in these Prague jazz days. So very, very different situation. Oh, I'm sorry. We need to change the chords here. So a very different hold on. Can you turn the lights back on one moment? Thanks. So you can see that even the audience here is quite a bit different than these underground audiences that were quite closed. Okay. So even seeing them, you can kind of feel it's quite a different feeling of even materially. I mean, the instruments they're using, where they're playing, their amplifiers, etc. Very different than what we see in the 70s. Here we are. So Die Buko is banned from Prague, but we can also I want to move a little bit east and go to Brno, which is in Moravia, east of Prague. Which also this time we have, Dubuque was not the only female instrumentalist occurring at this time. Very importantly, emerging from the scene in Brno was the violinist Iva Batova. Not only a violinist, very accomplished vocalist as well, and actress. And along with her partner Pavel Feit, they established a very influential and very interesting band, Dunaj. And Iva Batova, she's an interesting character because she was also an official musician at this time, but she was able to do so without compromising her art. So she also still kind of has a lot of respect even from underground members who could, their definitions of what was, good music and what was, playing for the state was a little bit different. But, so it's still important to remember that this was also kind of happening out of the 80s. Along with the Brno scene, we also have bands like Zakopse, Energie, which is one of the first punk bands that actually played in Czech Republic, in Czechoslovakia. They played also in 1979 in Nova Viska. At a concert as well, at this, which Dr. Malkovic spoke about. Yes, just may say Nede Hurley and Prokosi Yistui. So just like a selection of bands, but numerous bands. With Brno scene, I think it's been described as taking itself more seriously than the scene that was in Prague, but more seriously in terms of music, the music material, and also the lyrics and what they're singing about. Unfortunately, I don't have any lyrics with me, but The extent of how much of this is true certainly is debatable. Of course, any scene, anywhere, it develops around distinct personalities and charismatic leaders. So to say if this is all, you know, these are all musicians playing with each other in different bands, different groups, different formations. So if it was taking itself more seriously, it could have just been one or two very influential characters in this scene. So it's hard to describe it maybe as a full scene. But to get a kind of a sound of maybe what you heard from Dubuque to what we can hear going on, in Brno, I'll just play you a song with Iba Petova, Paula Fight. Fred Frith is not in this. I don't know why he is associated with this particular song. Very briefly, Fred Frith, Chris Culler were very important musicians in this time. They had connections to Czechoslovakia. 1979 Prague Jazz Days, they played here, there. So we'll just listen to now's Brno scene. Yeah, this was the film. Yeah,
exactly.
The short film. It's in this place itself, in the medical school. Yeah. We should be good to mention.
The Frith, the film?
It just said that this is shot from this film, Step Across the Border, which was made by Chris Cutler and Fred Frith, I think, and they were actually including this. So that's a very symbolic gesture that they include Eastern Europe. So I guess it's about this kind of new music in the world, but then they travel to Czechoslovakia and they record this scene with. Mm-hmm. So like they have Tom Kora and all this guys from the period, but there is a one shot like this one.
From this film. And this is kind of what I was saying before, like Fred Frith and Chris Culler definitely had a very important role in also some of this distribution of some of this music out of Czechoslovakia in the 80s. And Chris Culler's label Recommended Records was also releasing, I think it was an album called Points East, I think it was named, really taking some of the Samizdat recordings coming from the 80s. And then he's releasing it not directly through his label, but through a label he established in the Netherlands. I forget the name of the label, but he was still playing in Czechoslovakia, so he kind of, you know, it was a way for him to cover up his tracks, so he wasn't associated with the distribution. Even Fred Frith and Chris Clark were also, I think, very influential in 1979 when they first played here, because it also some of the first time some musicians in Czechoslovakia were also seeing that there was this alternative scene happening in the West. There were musicians who could not put out their albums, who could not find people to maybe release an album. So it was kind of also important too for like these kind of connections between alternative scenes across, well, from West and East. And they were kind of more associated with it with Miklos Hadima, who was a saxophone player, a guitar player, who was part of that alternative scene that I was mentioned earlier. So if we go, going back to here, if you go back to Brno, if we go back to Prague for a moment, I guess in a very important question when we're talking about music and society is how do actors make articulations between social life and forms of music. Looking at musicians from Prague, basically the world in which these younger musicians were born in the 1980s were born into is one that a lot of them, of course, found absurd. And for here, they were able to build on cultural resources left in place by such Prague writers as Kafka, mainly his work Metamorphosis, also Ladislav Klima, and even to romantic poets such as William Blake, to produce what was termed the Prague Grotesque. And grotesque, when you think about it, like in a literary term, these are a composition of the ludicrous and the fearful, a play with the absurd, a confrontation of anti-poetic and ugly, a contradiction of the double-faced fullness of life. So it's trying to link some of this musical material with social phenomena, which kind of allowing for this ongoing constitution of a musician's life world. An important point here, we can't just see that this was that new wave was a fashion in Czechoslovakia. It wasn't people just playing this because they heard it from the West. There's also musicians looking internally to their own cultural history to create really a subculture that was distinctively Czech. And there are several other examples that we talked about in the 1970s that kind of Dr. Malkovich spoke about too, is musicians going back into their own cultural history to inform them. So this is Prague and Brno. Actually, I'm going to attempt to do a little board work here. Okay. I'll do it as quickly as possible. And but I don't want to. I mean, in Prague, there's also things happening across. All the Czechoslovakia. So please excuse my poor version of Czechoslovakia. So something okay. So Prague, we have Brno. So let's take it in Bratislava. During this time, Bratislava, of course, had definitely its amount of Bratislava punk bands going through. But listen to this music, it's pretty pop rockish. It's punk, but with like this kind of this Slovak kind of feeling of melodies, perhaps based on the language. It's punk, but it's not punk as we hear going in maybe going to Czechoslovakia, which I'll come to. But what was happening really with Slovakian music at this time was a lot of like really the commercial Christian music was coming from really Bratislava this time. The most famous band, of course, was Ilan, the Sople Ide, really coming from Slovakia. So then also in Slovakia we had in Košice, there was one band called Lesni Zbivaci. And these were really a punk band that had a little bit of connection with kind of some of the publications going on up in Northern Czech Republic and this Novodisco where I love that's speaking about. So they had connections basically just through distribution of Samizdat magazines, also in Northern Czech Republic there's Teplice. Teplice is a spa town that it used to have a lot of quite famous people coming out of Karl Marx and drinking the water there for their health, and kind of rumor had it they had several illegitimate children, and this is why we had a lot of geniuses coming out of Teplice. but this is a very important band that came through here was FPB, Fourth Prize Band, a trio. The early stuff was very, very aggressive kind of punk, but the lead singer, Mira Vanek, was taking poems and lyrics and publications from 19th century National Revival, Narodni Obrazny, into Slovakian music in their music. FPB later moved to Prague and then established themselves as Uj Sme Domo, which is a fantastic band that still play today. And these Uspe Doma and Dibuk, which later turned into Vignetti, have a very kind of sister brotherhood type relationship from what I understand. FPB would also invite Dibuk to come play at their concerts. FPB weren't allowed to play officially because they didn't have someone who could guarantee that, or could be a guarantor for them to. So they asked Dibuk, who had a guarantor from a woman at this youth socialist club in Prague. So Dibuk could go up to Teplice and play a show, and FPB could open for them. Unfortunately, Dibuk was not the most organized group of women, so they missed their bus and this, and never made it to the concert. So police came and raided the concert. But also, because I was looking more also to other kind of forms of music that were coming, of course, we have from Austria and Germany, we have those people living on the border. You can also tune into, of course, Austrian and West German TV. And basically, there's also a certain sort of heavy metal happening also in Czechoslovakia. basically from more of these border regions of people tuning in, seeing, you know, KISS on TV, seeing the face paint, seeing the makeup and everything like this, and then basically replicating that. That took hold more in Ostrava in the later 80s, which was, you know, it's a coal mining town, harbor town. This is my impression that was a fashion. You can maybe go and interpret that as much and analyze as much, but it more or less was a fashion coming from the West. So this was going on, and then later in the 80s, of course, there were skinheads, and one of the more famous bands that was supposedly attached to skinheads was the band Orleek, which means like eagle or hawk. The hawk? Orleek?
Eagle.
Little Eagle. Okay, Little Eagle. And Daniel Landa was the lead singer of this band. He still performs today, although he denies that he's ever a skinhead, but I mean, if you listen to the lyrics, it's pretty, well, skinheadish. But anyway, that CD sold 150,000 copies in 1990, so there definitely was an audience for it. So very quickly, I'll close it up. Just kind of looking this 80s, basically what mechanisms brought about a shift in culture in the 1980s that could also lead to either the inclusion of women on the stage or more generally this different musical scape. Again, it's kind of this complex interrelation of, well, many different factors, but I'll look at just generation gap, the new styles, and changing compositions and performance. The first generation gap in the 1980s, which we spoke a little bit, or we talked a little bit about last week, of course, very, very important. So basically, people in the 1980s were being self-described as being born into a system of absurdity that was normalization, was this normalization of Czech society. As Aleš Opelka recounts, this generation understood the futility of hope and change of totalitarian social system and finding your inner freedom. Similarly, this idea of the generational shift in culture was echoed by Jakim Topol, who was integral in establishing the Samizdat publication Jedno Nohu, which later became Revolver Revue, who stated the difference in the 80s generation to the 70s were those that were not thrown into the world of the band or censored, but were simply born into it. And of course, this kind of echoes this absurd system of this kind of Prague grotesque aesthetic. If I may, just very quickly, also, we also mentioned this idea of this, that if you look actually outside of Czechoslovakia, the Poland, the town of Wrocław, also right after martial law in Poland, you had this movement called Pomarańczowa Alternativa, which is the Orange Alternative, what happened in Poland. And this was led by this guy, Meyer Friedrich Waldemar. And he kind of had this idea of socialist surrealism, that the system he was born into was so ridiculous it was a piece of art in itself. And so he kind of also would lead these happenings all across Poland, and it's fascinating. And they talk about dwarves and orange hats. It's quite interesting. But anyway, there's something similar that happened in Czechoslovakia in the late 80s called Society for a Happier Time, which is kind of similar to this orange alternative. So secondly, new styles. As mentioned before, a plethora of new styles and genres came in with the new wave and punk. Kind of, you can also say allowing for a gap for women musicians, also as seen happening in the West. Also, the new wave was happening in the USA, in the UK. We have instrumentals such as Patti Smith, you have Debbie Harry, Leading Blondie, Laurie Anderson, Annie Lennox, Grace Jones, Cocteau Twins from the UK. But in general, women were a lot more present in the new wave than perhaps music going into the 1970s. If you go a little bit into this music sociology, you can kind of think of new styles of music also inspiring new forms of consciousness. And if we think of like habits of cognition as ways of processing and perceiving reality, and if we follow Adorno's thinking of culture as a matrix that can structure subjectivity and emotional orientation, not only action, then we can conceive of these new styles of music as actively changing a perception and processing of women in and through music. And very importantly, then we can see music as not only an object of social relations, but active in creating social relations. It's not just a passive form, it's creating these new relations. So lastly, looking at changes in composition performance, which possibly could lead to more gender inclusion or reinscription in the 80s. Basically, social processes through which audiences interpret meetings in the underground in the 1970s were very specific for that community of people, as opposed to those festivals and concerts put on by the jazz section and these alternative bands, which had a very wide audience. As Dr. Makovets described, a lot of these little concerts, maybe 20 or 30 people or happenings, which is very difficult to find out about these concerts or to get to them unless maybe you were friends or had an invitation for the wedding that they perform at. So, in the underground, we had music composed for specific venues, places that helped determine collective representations and audience interpretations of these compositions. And any composer writing music for an anticipated audience influences the process of encoding meanings into musical scripts. In other words, performances in the underground had an anticipated audience drawn from a small community of individuals, which would suppose a similar system of collective representations invoked through audience interpretation. And of course, in the 80s, when you have this whole new wave of bands coming in, you also had new venues opening up. You had people organizing more concerts, so you had many more places to play. You also could be playing at these festivals of 500 to 1,000 people. So the way any individual, any musician composes, having that anticipated audience is going to be much different than any musician composing music for, you know, a small group of friends. So the meanings that were happening going into performance and the composition, you could consider as being very, very different than what was happening in the 1970s. Sorry, I'm keeping you kind of late. That's basically all I want to say. I mean, it's important though. There's a lot of things I did not really talk about, like the shift in material culture that's very important, and also the shift in visual culture. Of course, you have punks, you know, which also had a very strong visual presence, and so you had a lot of which, again, should be explored in term papers and thesis papers later. So, all right, thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Somebody has a very